you have questions set up for me?
I do. So if you're ready, this is Diana Brown interviewing Sean Manning on June 20th, 2014. Can you just say like your age and where you live and what you do if you...
Okay. Well, I'm 36 years old. I grew up in Overland Park, Kansas, where I live again. I lived in Lawrence for a while. Mm-hmm. I am a restaurant manager. I have academic experience in history and religious studies from the University of Kansas. So.
Okay, cool. So my first question will sort of get to what we were talking about before, which is kind of like, where are you coming from? And what's your religious background, like from your parents? What did you grow up doing?
I was raised Roman Catholic.
Okay.
My parents are, I guess you would call them conservative, but religiously they're pretty flexible. Mm-hmm.
What do you mean by conservative? Like politically conservative?
Politically, oh, okay. Although it really depends on the issue, I suppose. Mm-hmm. But they do tend to be kind of liberal with some, like, liberal as in they're flexible on a lot of religious concepts. They're not very strict Catholics. Mm-hmm. They do strictly adhere to official doctrine.
Mm-hmm.
My mother has always complained openly that there were not female priests in the Catholic Church, or that they didn't allow altar girls.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, when her church started doing it, she actually helped encourage the priest to do it, and they would keep track of where the bishop was so that he wouldn't find out.
Mm-hmm.
They hit him. My dad had always had kind of a... He always just had kind of a casual, hands-off kind of attitude towards religion. He went to the church and he participated in church, but mm-hmm. he never held too strict of a doctrine. He always maintained that the primary commandment was to love your neighbor as yourself, and basically treat other people decently and with respect.
Okay.
So
okay.
He tended to ignore or look over certain doctrines as it was convenient.
Okay. Yeah. So, I mean, at what age did you... I guess this is sort of a two-part question. I guess, like, at what age, on the one hand, did you start doing pagan things or reading about it? And on the other hand, would you ever identify yourself at any point in the past or now as a pagan? Or would you use some other word to describe yourself?
Well, in the past, I always looked back and... A lot of modern pagans will go back and say that, oh, this was like coming home. I always had this connection with nature, or I was clairvoyant, or I saw spirits, or things like that. I don't remember a lot of stuff like that.
Yeah.
I always remember my dreams being very significant,
mm-hmm.
but I didn't really associate that with anything that was outside of Catholicism,
because
my mother was very flexible. I guess you would call her superstitious.
Mm-hmm.
She believed in psychic phenomena. She believed in angels and spirits and things like that. So those kinds of experiences were explained by Catholicism.
Yeah.
So I never really worried about it. And when I was 7 years old, one of my close friends died of leukemia.
Mm-hmm.
And her mother was my mother's best friend.
Mm-hmm.
And that was how I knew her. And I remember her mother saying that when she died, she actually called out to her and said, "Mom, I just had a vision from Mary, and she says she's coming to take me tonight, and I'm going to go."
Mm-hmm.
And then she died that night.
Mm-hmm.
And my mother's always known, like, whenever her friends were in trouble, mm-hmm. or injured or sick, or when they've died, she just knew.
Mm-hmm.
She knew exactly when it was happening, and she would call them first. So looking back, I didn't see that as unusual.
Right.
I didn't see it as anything that was extra special.
Mm-hmm.
When I got older, I kind of went through an agnostic or an atheistic phase,
mm-hmm.
where I was questioning a lot of that. And part of that was I started having some negative experiences with the church itself. Mm-hmm. I started looking at the actual structure and political nature of the church as an entity versus the religion. Mm-hmm. And so I kind of rebelled a little bit. And but I really didn't get into anything that would be considered paganism or a cult until mm-hmm. I was about 16 or 17 years old.
Okay. Yeah.
And it's actually a funny story. I tell it a lot. Mm-hmm. I got into it to impress a girl.
Okay. I see.
So she said that she could see auras, mm-hmm. and I couldn't see auras, mm-hmm. and I wanted to impress her, and so I had a friend of mine, he bought me a book for Christmas on how to see and read auras. Mm-hmm. And to this day, I cannot see auras. And I think I'm friends with her on Facebook, and I hear from her once every year or so.
Yeah.
But, you know, both of those efforts failed, but I'm still involved in all this stuff. So, yeah.
So what happened after that that sort of got you more involved? Or, like, how did your path start sort of evolving?
Well, I started reading tarot. Mm-hmm. And when I started reading tarot, my friend Tim is the one that introduced me to, he's the one that bought me the book.
Okay.
And he introduced me to tarot, and he introduced me to the person that was teaching him tarot, a gentleman by the name of Joseph Lubin.
Okay.
And he had these classes mm-hmm. that he was teaching on metaphysics and tarot. But what they really were classes on occult Kabbalah.
Okay. Yeah.
And so I started getting really heavily into that, reading books by Aleister Crowley, mm-hmm. and everything just kind of went on from there. The idea that you could attain altered states of consciousness mm-hmm. and have an impact on your reality or on future outcomes was very appealing to me. Mm-hmm. You know, I was young, I had very little, if any, direction in life, and I was mm-hmm. looking for some way to kind of get a grip on things. So.
Yeah. Huh. So I guess how important then, it seems like, I mean, people were certainly important in your sort of development, basically early on. Like, how important, I guess, was and is community or, you know, people sort of face to face?
Most, I kind of had two groups that I worked with as far as like people. Mm-hmm. There was an online community that I got involved with in the old Yahoo message boards. Mm-hmm. And when I started out, when I first got online, I was young, I was cocky, I was arrogant, and I was, you know, basically bullshitting a lot just to kind of try and impress and intimidate people. And it didn't work. Mm-hmm. And I very quickly learned that and stopped because mm-hmm. it was obnoxious. Mm-hmm. But there were some online message boards that people would just code to discuss things.
Yeah.
Just to talk shop. Mm-hmm. And so I kind of got some perspective outside of what I was used to. Mm-hmm. As far as local community, the personal interaction I had was in Joseph's metaphysics class. And there was kind of a core group of about six or seven people mm-hmm. that kept going. And then we had layers outside of that. The class would go anywhere from five or six people to about 12 or 13, depending on how many people we'd get.
Yeah.
And you had a lot of people from a lot of different backgrounds that were trying to learn different things. Mm-hmm. And we just kind of went there and we listened to what he said and we discussed it and we practiced sometimes techniques or just talked about our own backgrounds and experiences, and we all got a lot from it. And he played the role of facilitator fairly well mm-hmm. because he would take what one person said and tie it into what another person said and bring things around full circle. And it would, he would speak directly to one person or another person, and it would impact that person directly but would also be relevant for somebody else. Mm-hmm.
Was he teaching out of a shop or out of his home? Or?
He taught out of his home for a while, mm-hmm. and he also taught. The class eventually moved to our friend Rick's house, mm-hmm. and that's kind of where it stayed for a while. It then became off and on as both of them had health issues and mm-hmm. other things going on personally, and it kind of fell apart.
Yeah.
After a few times, it would stop and then start up again, mm-hmm. but eventually just kind of ended, and the way that he described it was that the people who got what they needed moved on, and the people that stayed mm-hmm. were the ones that were never going to get it. So and eventually it got to the point where me and my friend Tim we weren't getting anything else from it, so we kind of moved on and made our own little group where we kind of worked with a few people. And
okay.
That didn't end up working out very well either. So.
So you're doing these things when you're a teenager. So what do your parents think about this?
At the time, my mother, first she went through the it's a phase.
Mm-hmm.
And then she freaked out because she thought I was worshiping Satan.
Mm-hmm.
And we actually had a talk once. And what she said is, she just asked me outright.
Mm-hmm.
She said, do you still acknowledge God or have you turned away from him?
Mm-hmm.
And I told her, Mom, what we're doing is founded in Jewish philosophy. What I deal with, you could term God.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not questioning that. What I'm questioning at is how you interact with it.
Mm-hmm.
And she was okay with that.
Yeah.
As long as I wasn't worshiping Satan, she was fine with it.
Right.
A few years later, she started changing her mind and started ribbing me on it a little bit. And even now, she'll make jokes about my witchy stuff and she'll antagonize me a little bit. Not very severely, but lightly.
Mm-hmm.
My uncle's not very forgiving about it. He actually left, when I was staying with my parents for a while, he actually left a clove of garlic in my room on top of my tarot decks.
Okay.
And part of that's funny because that's the way he is, but it was also a pretty blatant statement. My dad doesn't care.
Okay.
My dad has actually asked me technical questions about the occult, about magic, about tarot readings, and about things like that. And he's shown an aptitude for it and an interest in it. He's just never actually gotten into it. And I think that if he actually did, he'd probably work with it fairly well. But he just...
Yeah.
He didn't care as long as I wasn't a jerk to people. That's pretty much it.
Mm-hmm. And can you talk about, I guess... I don't know how your practice has sort of evolved. So it started out with like this kind of Kabbalistic, philosophy and techniques. And, you know, at this point, I know that you have some involvement with sort of like Roman, I don't know if you would call it Reconstructionist or.
You could call it Reconstructionist influenced.
Okay.
I suppose.
Yeah. But I mean, so it's been, you know, 20 years basically that you've been practicing.
Has it? Ouch.
So yeah, what's changed over the years? And
well,
how, you know?
I was going through the Kabbalah,
mm-hmm.
and then I got into chaos magic.
Mm-hmm.
And the core principle of chaos magic is that belief itself is a tool and can be changed, used, and adapted as needed.
Right.
So a really good chaos magician is perfectly fine with being a monotheist, and then shifting to a polytheist, or then becoming an agnostic, or even an atheist,
mm-hmm.
depending on the environment they're in, who they're interacting with, or what they need to do.
Mm-hmm.
If you've got a client, and that's really what it comes down to at this point, mm-hmm. if you've got a client that's dealing with a disturbance in their home,
mm-hmm.
if they're Catholic, you would want to come in with, you'd want to put yourself in a monotheistic framework, you'd want to come in with guardian angels
mm-hmm.
and saints, and you would want to push it out that way.
Mm-hmm.
If you've got somebody that's more new agey, then you might want to come in with some sage and some quartz crystals and do something a little more general. If you're dealing with somebody who's an out and out pagan,
mm-hmm.
we would have a completely different approach.
Yeah.
And the whole key of chaos magic is that you should be able to shift all those, because the belief itself just serves as a tool to make sense of the experience, which
mm-hmm.
is brought on by a certain practice, and that practice at its core is similar enough through all of those different belief systems that it makes no difference which one you go with.
So is the belief there, is it that you're really changing your beliefs, or that you're sort of accommodating other people's beliefs by sort of changing your framework?
Both.
Okay. Okay.
But when I got into that, it... I kind of went through an agnostic phase
mm-hmm.
and just kind of looked at what the techniques were for achieving altered states of consciousness or doing things. And I wasn't focusing too much on religious devotion or anything like that.
Mm-hmm.
And I stayed that way for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
At that point, I would question whether it would have been appropriate to call myself a pagan.
Right.
And I actually had that discussion, that internal debate and discussed it with other people, because I viewed myself as, I guess you'd call me a mystic or a magician or a lot of other things, but I didn't have that religious component.
Yeah.
And I would say, I'm trying to think how long ago it was. What year is it now? Okay. I'd say maybe about 6 years ago or so, 6 or 7 years ago, I started feeling an absence. When my grandmother died and my cousin died, my cousin died of leukemia in around 2001. And I went to those funeral services, and they were very Catholic, and I found myself missing that religious experience, that emotional experience. It had become an intellectual experience, and I wanted more of that emotional comfort. And that kind of accelerated and compounded throughout the years, and around 2007 or so, I started feeling an absence of that religious experience, and I started looking for a god. Who do I devote myself to? And I've actually written, I write under a nom de plume online, and I've written on this topic of finding, how do you know what gods to align yourself with? What do you look for? And I went through and tried to devise, you know, a method for how do you figure out what you should go with. And I picked a couple, and I did research on them, and I made some offerings, and I took it as a sign when I lit some incense and poured some wine and made an offering, and the incense went out. I couldn't keep it lit. And I took that as a sign. This is the wrong one. And I did that for a few times, and I struggled with this for a few years before I finally settled on the Roman pantheon. And I'm, for my ethnic background, my father's half of the family is Irish and my mother's is Italian. And I always identified myself with the Irish side of the family. And something happened about 5 years ago or so where I suddenly shifted and made that identification with the Italian side. And at that point, my association with Rome just clicked. And I felt myself, I was dealing with some, I guess you'd call them aggression issues. And so I was attracted to Mars. And I went through that and set up a devotional practice. And it's adjusted significantly over the years, but that's kind of how I got on that. I was actively looking, and finally I found one that I was comfortable with. And I went through a period where I looked at like Nova Roma and some of the Reconstructionist organizations. I actually have a tunica and a toga that I've made by hand. It's not an official toga because it's not wool, because wool's expensive. But I have used those in devotional practices, and I have a lararium set up for my ancestral spirits. And I would even be willing to share photographs of some of those. You'd be interested.
That would be great.
My altar combines those devotional elements. They're not strictly Reconstructionist, though. I have metal on my altar. You know, a strict Reconstructionist wouldn't do that. But I've kind of adapted some of those themes and combined them back to the Kabbalistic themes of planetary spheres, and the gods have kind of taken on those roles for me of, this is how the Roman deity actually acts, and this is a related sphere that Kabbalistically would be associated with that god. And so I've kind of blended those together. And that's how I handle the Roman side. I also have gotten a lot more active in celebrating the Wiccan calendar, the cycle of the year, and I view that as like more of a cultural thing. It's just because so many other pagans and neo-pagans are familiar with that and celebrate it. It's an excuse for people to get together. So
I was going to ask, I mean, how important is community for you now, both in a more sort of like general social sense like that, and also in terms of like, you know, do you know other people who are invested in sort of like the Roman pantheon? Or
I do not know anybody else in the area that is involved in worship of the Roman Pantheon.
Okay.
The only organizations I've found have been groups like Nova Roma, mm-hmm. and they're very heavily politicized. Mm-hmm. Nova Roma describes itself as a micronation.
Oh.
And that's way more than I'm willing to invest into.
Yeah.
I don't want to change my name and go for a political position in a micronation. I just want to worship the divine in a way that's comfortable and yeah. find peace and success and happiness in my life and stuff. Mm-hmm. So for community, I have a network of friends mm-hmm. that most of my really close friends are involved in metaphysics or paganism in some way.
Mm-hmm.
Even my one of my friends, she's very Christian.
Yeah.
She is a very talented tarot reader,
mm-hmm.
and she is a strong empath, and she has precognitive dreams
mm-hmm.
and premonitions.
Mm-hmm.
And she's very open to all that stuff. But
yeah.
when it comes down to it, she's Christian.
Yeah.
My ex-girlfriend is a rather potent kitchen witch.
Okay.
She does lots of witchcraft, lots of herbal stuff,
mm-hmm.
very Catholic.
Mm-hmm.
And she had discomfort with that because she associated with a lot of pagans.
Mm-hmm.
And they just assumed she was pagan, and she would have to dance around the fact that she was Christian
mm-hmm.
because she was afraid they would reject her.
Yeah.
And she... You can't be Catholic and hang out with pagans and feel fully a part of that group, but you can't be a witch and hang out with Catholics
mm-hmm.
and feel totally in with that group. So she had that kind of issue she was dealing with.
Yeah.
But a lot of friends are very important to me.
Mm-hmm.
I have a small group of very close friends.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of them are open to that. They kind of have to be.
Yeah.
'Cause it's pretty much how I am.
Yeah.
I also have a, because I don't have that circle of Roman-based pagans, I have other pagan groups that I've been involved with.
Mm-hmm.
The Tribe 3
right.
that I've become more and more actively involved with is a good one because it's just nice to be with people that get together for mutual things like that.
Mm-hmm.
I still talk to Joseph and some of the people from that group, but that group has fallen apart, and
right.
most people have either died or gone.
Yeah. But Joseph is still obviously like a
Joseph is still he's a very close friend of mine now.
Okay,
I will often call him my mentor. He introduces me as his son.
Okay,
he very much is a father figure,
mm-hmm.
which is difficult sometimes because he's been very supportive and offered a lot of guidance and instruction,
mm-hmm.
but he also, shall we say, is a product of his times,
uh-huh.
which is a code for he has a lot of racist and misogynistic attitudes that
I see
very, very diplomatically sidestep or try and correct him on. And
how old is he?
67.
Oh, okay.
He's either 67 or 68. He's only a couple years younger than my parents. My dad is 70 now.
Oh,
so.
Okay.
Yeah, he actually was, they didn't actually meet each other, but he was in the Navy at the same time of my father, and they were both stationed together in Norfolk.
Oh, wow.
For a year or so.
That's interesting. Yeah. Pretty coincidence.
But, as far as, like, the greater community,
mm-hmm. Is there much of a community in Overland Park, or resources there, or?
Overland Park itself, the big area is there's a shop called Crescent Springs in downtown Overland Park,
mm-hmm.
and there's that. But the Kansas City area in general has a pretty extensive pagan or metaphysical community.
Yeah.
And you have the hub, the center point will always be Aquarius in Westport.
Hmm.
And Barb Criswell, who runs Aquarius, is a very significant and very diplomatic and well-respected figure. She doesn't take, like, a leadership role as far as affecting the direction that the community takes. She
mm-hmm.
doesn't make, like, decrees or put herself up as a figurehead, but she is incredibly respected, and what she says is taken very seriously in a lot of things.
Okay.
And she's a sweetheart, too. She's a very friendly person, and
nice.
She will just let you spill your heart out for
yeah.
stupid things to her, and... as long as you're not taking away from her business too much. You know?
Mm-hmm.
But there's a pretty extensive network of... the Penguin community is mostly centered around authors and shop owners. And so you have a couple shops in Leavenworth, in the Kansas City area, in Lawrence, mm-hmm. and one in Manhattan that I know about. Mm-hmm. And most of those shop owners are pretty well connected.
Yeah.
You also have a psychic fair circuit, mm-hmm. and you have certain people that run covens or other groups that help organize or work with those fairs.
Yeah.
And a lot of those are run by the same people. The Phoenix Goddess Circle is one such group.
Mm-hmm.
As far as I know, they're a women-only group, mm-hmm. Although they have a couple of male, I don't know if you call them allies, outliers, pets, whatever, that are associated with the group, but they still don't go to, like, the primary functions.
Yeah.
And those people... they have their fingers in a lot of pies in the community, and they help organize a lot of things.
Okay.
So there's a lot of networking going on, and a lot of smaller groups that I'm not personally involved with, but that I know of, and that they interact with each other and put on events and activities, and mm-hmm. Pagan Pride Day, and then, of course, there's also...
Pagan Pride Day is in Kansas City? Is it Kansas City 1?
Yeah, it was... I think it was last August or September, and it's in Mission, Kansas.
Oh, okay.
And they just have some vendors and other things going on up there, mm-hmm. some workshops and other stuff.
Yeah.
And then, of course, there's Heartland Spiritual Alliance, mm-hmm. which runs the Heartland Pagan Festival, and mm-hmm. then there's Earth Rising that maintains the Gaia Retreat Center.
Now, is Earth Rising specifically... Is it a pagan group? Like, what are they?
Earth Rising is a group
that
is specifically designed just to maintain the Gaia Retreat.
Okay.
They maintain the land, they set up reservations, and mm-hmm. they take care of the land itself.
Okay.
To my knowledge, it is a pagan group in the sense that most of the people that are in it are pagan.
Mm-hmm.
But the Gaia Retreat is open to all people of all religions, as long as they want to come there and play nice.
Yeah. Yeah.
So.
Okay. I was going to ask then, are there sort of like, I don't know, does land or specific spots, they play like any important role for you? You know, places like Gaia, for instance.
Gaia, definitely.
Yeah.
I have a rather personal and kind of intense connection to the land at Gaia.
Mm-hmm.
I guess you would call it a spiritual connection, or... I actually had an experience up there where I made a very deep connection to the land.
Hmm.
And plus, when you go someplace like that and have, you know, religious experiences or just parties or other things up there, you know, it affects you. You stay there, and it is a retreat. You mm-hmm. retreat from the rest of society and go to this place where everyone's got kind of a mindset that's outside of normal everyday life. And
yeah.
That becomes significant, and mm-hmm. so the place where you hold that at becomes significant.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure that if we had an event like Heartland Pagan Festival someplace else, it would still have a significance, but the land itself is important.
Yeah.
So, yeah. Other places, there's a location on Indian Creek by off of 107th and Nall.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a park up along there. It's Nall Park.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a place where the creek goes through the park. And there's like a little forested area. And I used to go there a lot and do meditations and things like that.
Hmm.
And that's kind of a personal spot. Because you can climb back through the woods and then go down into the creek bed, which is far below the level of the path. And you can hide down in there. And people can walk by. They could be walking right above you and they can't see you.
Yeah.
And so... that's kind of a place where I've retreated in the past.
Mm-hmm.
Shawnee Mission Park has a lot of places that I've been and spent time with people of that same mindset. And we've done exercises or meditations and things like that, or just kind of gone to hang out and
mm-hmm.
get away.
Yeah.
There was one spot where some friends of mine and I, we actually set up a ritual site.
Mm-hmm.
And the way that this was actually near the interstate, and it was at a Cloverleaf interchange on the interstate. You had the main road go through, and it was a road that isn't very well traveled mm-hmm. most times. And then the interstate goes by, and you've got the little Cloverleaf exchanges on the exit.
Yeah.
So you have this bluff mm-hmm. that's surrounded by the exit ramp.
Yeah.
And it's just kind of sitting there on its own, and it's elevated very high so you can get on top of it and mm-hmm. people can't see you. So we found a way to climb up there easily, and mm-hmm. we made a clearing, and mm-hmm. we got some stones and made like a little ritual circle. And mm-hmm. we used to go up there and hold ritual.
Mm-hmm.
And that was a pretty significant spot for a while, but then mm-hmm. that group of people, we had a falling out.
Hmm.
And the spot just became kind of too difficult to maintain on my own and even to access.
Yeah.
You've got to be very careful when, especially when you're doing stuff with witchcraft,
yeah.
when you're going out at night by yourself and the cops will find you and you've got, you know, swords or knives and stuff. And
yeah.
Like, what are you doing here? You can't have that here. Come with us.
Yeah.
Olathe Lake, there were a couple spots down there that we used to meet up. I mean, basically mm-hmm. anywhere you had a park or an easily accessible natural area that yeah. was isolated,
mm-hmm.
we would find it and we would go there.
Yeah.
There was even a cave complex up near Liberty, Missouri that was an abandoned, it was an abandoned storage cave
mm-hmm.
that was partially collapsed.
Yeah.
And we would go in there and just, you could go mm-hmm. in there and, I mean, it's dark, it's quiet. You can do some interesting things in there.
Mm-hmm.
Or you could just go around with a flashlight and find the graffiti that says what year they had the party there.
Right? Yeah.
So, but anything that removes you from the mindset of regular everyday life
mm-hmm.
it was valuable. And any place you could go back to that was secluded enough to do that.
Mm-hmm. Can you talk about, I guess, I don't know, what some of the reasons are that you would do ritual?
Magic, getting a bunch of people together and having them focus on attaining a common goal for one person or for everyone there.
Mm-hmm.
The idea being that the more people you have raising that energy mm-hmm. or consciousness, the more effective it would be.
Mm-hmm.
At the time, a religious experience wasn't something that I was looking for, but there have been plenty of rituals, especially recently,
mm-hmm.
that have had very significant religious experiences for me, too.
Mm-hmm.
And it's the same thing. You have a group of people, they raise a certain energy, and you have that contact with the numinous, and you have that experience, and mm-hmm. it affects everyone a little differently, but you have a group of people there that are still having an experience.
Yeah.
And they can support you as you try and make sense of it. And yeah. that's pretty important.
And what's the difference, I guess, between... Can you talk a little bit more about this distinction between religious and not religious and what the difference is in the experience?
Well, ooh, that's a good one. I would say that the religious, the emphasis on the religious is... and you end up using the word spiritual, and we have to define that. What I consider religious is getting in touch with the divine, or whatever you'd want to call the divine, in a way that you have an experience that you have a connection with the divine, and mm-hmm. ideally you would bring something back from that.
Mm-hmm.
It would change you somehow or give you insight somehow. But what you're really looking for is an ecstatic experience where you have this contact
mm-hmm.
with something
yeah.
that is beyond the edge of what we consider the real or the normal.
So contact, connection, interaction, that's sort of the
yeah. Magic itself is, it can involve altered states of consciousness, but for me, magic is very much about reaching that state of consciousness in order to achieve direct results.
Mm-hmm.
You do it for a purpose.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes there are some types of magic that are spiritual in nature, and mm-hmm. especially when you're dealing with Kabbalah, you have a lot of ritual magic that is aimed at attaining higher states of consciousness in union with the Godhead.
Mm-hmm.
So you do have that. But you have... very much you have a specific goal in mind, and with a religious experience it's a little more vague.
Mm-hmm.
It's also can be some more communal,
not goal directed necessarily beyond yeah. the connecting,
but it's just more of I would say gaining a perspective on the fact that you're not the center of the universe.
Okay.
That there is something beyond your understanding and that you're capable of getting a taste of it, but you can't fully grasp it.
Okay.
There's something beyond the edge that you can just barely make out, but if you actually fully reach out and grasp it,
mm-hmm.
you have to go over the edge yourself,
mm-hmm.
and you're not coming back.
Mm-hmm.
So there's kind of, I've worked with the idea of the liminal a lot in some of my writings, where
okay.
witches and magicians and wizards or whatever you have,
yeah.
the people of the crossroads,
mm-hmm.
they exist in that liminal place and deal with liminal things.
Yeah.
They help you make sense of things that don't fit into normal world. When people die,
mm-hmm.
when people are hurt, when you have unusual experiences, when things don't make sense, there, we exist in that kind of in-between place where the unusual isn't that unusual for us.
Mm-hmm.
And so when we encounter people that are lost in there, it's either our obligation to guide, you know, comfort them and guide them back into the real.
Yeah.
Or teach them what we know so they can help us out.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, people that keep moving on don't generally come back.
Yeah.
I guess that would be where they die or something.
So I guess I want to back up a little bit and ask you to tell me a little bit about the Kabbalah. You know,
okay.
the elevator speech, I guess, about, you know, not really, but I guess talk about for our listening audience, like, what is the Kabbalah? What do you mean when you talk about
the Kabbalah is a system of mysticism that is based out of Jewish philosophy and mythology, and also of medieval Christian philosophy and mythology.
Mm-hmm.
And it is essentially a series of correspondences
okay.
between different elements of reality to different aspects of the divine.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that the simplest way that I can explain it is one Kabbalistic author and magician, Lon Milo Duquette.
Mm-hmm.
I love that guy. He was a student of Israel Regardi. And he basically said that the Kabbalah is a way of studying the world around you
mm-hmm.
and focusing on how everything is interconnected to the point where you can look at one thing and see the entire universe reflected in it
mm-hmm.
and focus on that to the point where your mind snaps, you go insane, and achieve enlightenment. And for a lot of the more traditional religious Kabbalah, the whole point of it is to attain that union with the Godhead, to attain that kind of enlightenment.
Mm-hmm.
And most of the more ceremonial magic versions of the Kabbalah have the same goal. They just accept that if you're going to align yourself with certain aspects of the divine in certain
mm-hmm.
ways, the road works both ways.
Mm-hmm.
The divine essence can influence you, but you can also influence reality in general, and you can cause things to go better for you or
mm-hmm.
things to go worse for someone else,
mm-hmm.
or you can adjust. You can stack the deck, as it
mm-hmm.
were.
And it's all based on these connections
yes.
among everything.
It really essentially is the way that everything is interconnected and how mm-hmm. you influence those connections.
Okay. Well, how important have books been for you?
Recently, not very. I have
yeah.
kind of stagnated a little bit. But with anyone who's involved in the occult or paganism, books are vital.
Yeah.
Especially since we're still very small in numbers and we're still very spread out.
Mm-hmm.
And like I said, the centers of the pagan community are shops
mm-hmm.
and authors. We
yeah.
don't have celebrities. We have authors.
Yeah.
Those are the big names.
Mm-hmm.
Books are vitally important because that's where you learn your stuff.
Yeah.
It's really hard, especially if you live out in rural Kansas or even in Kansas City, to
mm-hmm.
go out and find a group of people. You start with the books.
Yeah.
And that's where you learn all your background, and that's where you learn all your theories, and then you start through... The bookstores always had the interest of... You meet people in the bookstore.
Right, yeah.
you talk to people there. You would go online and do searches for people talking about this book, and you'd ask questions about it, and they'd recommend more books. And that's how a lot of people learn a lot of their practices. And then maybe you'd... Most pagan practitioners are solitary.
Yeah.
So books become the primary source of information. And then a lot of people will maintain their own records, develop their own rituals, their own correspondences. And then you have the Book of Shadows, which is the record of a coven or a magical group. I draw a distinction between a Book of Shadows and a journal. I keep a journal. It's personal. It's just for me.
I see.
Book of Shadows is typically meant for other people to see as well.
I see.
It's meant to be passed on or reviewed by other people.
Mm-hmm.
So, but writing your own book is actually religiously significant in a lot of Wiccan groups.
Yeah.
You would have, you'd have books and sources that you'd read for certain things, but then you have your own book that the group itself makes, and that becomes specific to that group and important to that group.
Well, then, I guess as a follow-up to that, I mean, how important is creativity, or how important is sort of like art making in your practice, for instance?
In my practice,
yes,
it depends on how you define art. In general, art is very widely, creativity in art is very widely prized in the pagan community. And in fact, there are some people that I've encountered that say that you can't really be pagan if you're not an artist. And I find that a little pretentious and obnoxious, because what it implies to me is that if you can't draw or play music, you can't really be pagan.
Yeah. Well, what if what it means is that, you know, you must sort of necessarily be kind of coming up with ritual and stuff like that, and that's an art form in itself.
Well, you could argue that, but the people that I was specifically dealing with were arguing specifically that if you can't draw or paint or something, you're not receiving divine inspiration and you don't have a connection to the divine.
I see.
So, but I've also been told by people that I can't practice magic because I have a penis.
Okay.
So, you know, it
a lot of ideas
there's a
out there.
Lot of ways of looking at the world. But,
yeah.
Well,
for yourself, according to your own definitions.
I value art. I can't draw to save my life.
Okay.
I can't paint very well.
Mm-hmm.
I can sculpt.
Okay.
I can sculpt very well.
Mm-hmm.
Or at least I used to be able to. I actually have my lararium, and I don't have statuary on my altar.
Mm-hmm.
I actually got Sculpey, that little home-baked clay.
Oh, okay.
And I have made busts of my gods.
Cool. Sorry to interrupt you for just a second, can you give a brief definition of what a lararium is?
A lararium is a specific shrine to the ancestral gods, to the paterfamilias, the specific, I guess you'd call it a deity or spirit that is embodiment of the family itself.
Okay.
I believe historically it was considered that the oldest living patriarch was regarded in that way, and they would actually have a representation of that person, or I'm not too up on my research, I've been slacking. It may also refer to the oldest remembered male figure, but you would actually have a figure of that family member, a figure that embodied the spirit of the family itself and its lineage and history. And then you have little figures of cupbearers, and you usually have like a little shelf around it, and you'd have a place where you leave offerings of incense or wine or other things, and there's a very specific way traditionally you're supposed to do it, and I don't adhere to that because it's very technical and everything, and I basically have a little thing that I've made out of Sculpey that looks kind of cool, and I don't have an image of a particular person. I actually have the shield from my family crest.
Okay.
That represents the family quite well for me. And then I have a little incense burner in front of it.
Okay.
And I've got a couple other trinkets on that part of the altar.
Yeah.
I actually have it in front of a large replica of the Statue of Liberty that I got from Ellis Island when I was like 9. And then I have a little copy of the Constitution because I figure that, you know, home, country, all that stuff should all kind of go together. So, you know, it's more of a gesture, I suppose.
Yeah.
I don't actually worship political figures. But that's pretty much it.
Okay. But I mean, for instance, I don't know, so you keep I guess here's sort of a two-part question. You know, one is sort of a follow-up, you know, insofar as, so writing is something that's important to you, and you've blogged, and I don't know if you're still blogging or not, but, you know, that to me, it's sort of, you know, being participating in a spiritual community or a religious community or yes. something like that. So, and that's also
yeah,
creating.
I very much consider I've been frustrated because I haven't been writing recently.
Yeah.
And I do view that as a spiritual exercise and as an expression of myself.
Mm-hmm.
And I've actually, I'll even do tarot readings online for people and then do write-ups, and I try and be poetic about how I write it. Mm-hmm. I try and make it entertaining. I answer questions about it. But writing is a spiritual exercise for me. Music is very important to me.
Mm-hmm.
I can play music not very well. I'm not professionally trained or anything, and I haven't done it seriously for a long time, but mm-hmm. I have a couple instruments, and I'll occasionally the music I play when I give offerings is part of the offering.
Oh, okay.
I've got a really great I've got a couple of albums. It's from a group of archaeology students and classic students that actually went and reconstructed the music of the time as they think it would have been using authentic reconstructed instruments.
Oh,
and
neat.
It's really interesting. Some of it's a little stuffy. It sounds like a bunch of grad students playing that aren't familiar with the instruments trying to play them, but the later ones get very, and they actually those groups actually consulted like the HBO miniseries Rome and helped them develop the soundtrack for it.
That's cool.
And I love the soundtrack for that too, so but I can do some of the sculpting, the music, those aspects of art I can very well do. And I don't write poetry or anything specifically as devotionals, but I suppose I could.
Mm-hmm.
But those elements are pretty important. And even in general, if I'm not creating something, the way my altar itself is set up is an aesthetic quality that's important to me. It can't just be the right stuff kind of piled together. It has to be arranged
right.
in a way that feels right.
Yeah.
So I think there's kind of an art to that.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I really consider the whole spectrum of, I mean, it's a, you know, you're creating what you do, like it's inspired by, but ultimately your practice, you create it, you know, so I don't know, it seems like a wholly creative endeavor to me, really. But
food is also very important.
Hmm.
Food offerings on special occasions, and for me, if I were to call myself an artist for anything, it's because I'm a cook, and I take a lot of pride in my cook and or in my food that I cook and the way that I do it and the way that I present it. So that's definitely an art for me.
Mm.
So.
And what kind of stuff would you make for an offering?
I actually developed these things. I read up on a Roman rite. I'm probably pronouncing it wrong. Suetolia.
Mm-hmm.
And apparently during a ritual, they would actually slaughter a bull, a pig, and a sheep.
Mm-hmm.
And they would parade, they would roast them and parade the meat around an area to purify it.
Mm-hmm.
And then they would have a feast featuring those three meats and whatever else.
Purify the area or purify the meat?
The area.
The area, okay.
It actually purified the area by parading those meats around.
Yeah.
It would purify that area.
Okay.
And it was used to like dedicate buildings and marketplaces and other things like that. But it was a purification ritual. And so what I did is I looked, okay, you've got beef, you've got lamb, and you've got pork.
Yeah.
And so I actually got inspired by it, and I went out and got some little cuts of, I got some steaks and some lamb, and I cut them up into little cubes or little kind of strips, and I put, I marinated the steak in red wine and olive oil, and the lamb in lemon juice and olive oil, and some garlic and seasonings, and then I cut them into little strips, and I've had those together, and I put an onion slice on one side and a bell pepper slice on the other, and then I wrapped them in bacon, and then I broiled them, and besides the fact that they're absolutely delicious, leaving that as an offering for me was a modern interpretation of that that ritual. And the first time I did it, I actually had one, and I paraded it around the house on a platter and then set it down on the altar.
Cool.
Otherwise, normally it's just kind of whatever you've got from the meal, and sometimes the meals are catered to whatever holiday, but
yeah,
it's just kind of whatever you've got. You would leave some there.
Okay.
Most of what I leave is wine or rum or bourbon, depending on what deity I'm dealing with. Jupiter is partial to bourbon.
Okay. From personal experience, or
from personal experience, yeah. And also from some experiences that other people I've talked to mm-hmm. have recommended. For me, Venus prefers rum.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure why that is, but Venus tends to prefer rum. Mm-hmm. Mars is okay with rum or Venus or rum or bourbon.
Yeah,
and they all go with wine. Mercury loves coffee.
Oh. Okay. Let's see.
Oh, it increases your mental acuity. It's perfect. So, for my personal practice, I will tend to leave offerings to specific deities based on the day of the week. Wednesday is associated with Mercury. Mm-hmm. So on that day, I would light incense to Mercury and then maybe leave a little espresso.
Yeah.
In his offering dish. And then on Fridays, that would be Venus. And so I would leave some incense for her and pour some rum or some wine in her little dish.
Yeah.
And I have little shrines set up to each deity on the altar. And they're very specific what's included. Like my Mercury shrine, I don't have a little bust or statue of Mercury.
Mm-hmm.
So I was looking for something to represent him. And I have an old cell phone. So that seem to embody pretty well the idea of communication and that quickness. And so I have a cell phone, one of my favorite pens, and a 20-sided die.
Okay. Cool. A little bit over here. How important has the internet been to you?
Vital. Absolutely vital. A lot of the biggest connection that I made without the internet was my friend Tim, and through him, Joseph.
Okay.
And that was pure happenstance.
Yeah.
basically, Tim used to get high with a girl whose mother was dating Joseph at the time. I may not have wanted to say that. Whatever. Anyways.
I can cut out whatever you want.
But I'm sure it was past the statute of limitations. But beyond that, a large portion of the other connections that I've made were based upon contacts that I've made online or groups that I've found online.
Mm-hmm.
Even my experience with the pagan group at KU, the Wiccan Pagan Alliance, which then became KU Cauldron and then became Wiccan Pagan Alliance again, and then I believe is defunct.
Yeah, we were talking about that earlier.
But I found that through an online search.
Yeah. You know?
I suppose I could have asked around at student services and found it, but
right.
Everything's online.
Yeah.
And there are several people that I've met that I consider friends that I talk to that I've never met in person. I've only known them online. And especially now, you know, I run a blog, I've got a Tumblr account, and I've met a lot of people through Tumblr that I consider reasonably close friends that I've talked to about some personal stuff, and they've given me advice. We've even done like video chats with like five or six people together, and you know, that's a good time. The theory is that we were supposed to talk about pagan stuff, but we ended just gossiping.
Okay.
You know? and that's good. That's part of it.
Yeah.
Connecting with people is very important to me. Hospitality I view it as a religious obligation, both from the aspect of my Roman orientation and also just the family tradition of the fact that my mother's side of the family is Italian. And even on my father's Irish side, we're hospitality cultures. Hospitality is very important. You take somebody into your house, you take care of them, you feed them. Food is very important there. So
let's see. Well, I guess, have you ever experienced any problems because of doing what you do and being open about it, I guess?
Nothing too directly.
That's good.
most of the problems that I've encountered have been pretty passive or minor.
Mm-hmm.
People giving you dirty looks if you wear a pentacle necklace out in public, mm-hmm. People accusing you of worshiping Satan, people passive-aggressively asking you to go to church with them, people mm-hmm. saying they'll pray for you. Those are annoyances to me. Yeah. It's not a big deal. And honestly, I know that on some level deep down inside they mean well.
Yeah.
And it doesn't bother me if someone's genuinely concerned for me. even if it's annoying, it doesn't bother me that much. Mm-hmm. If someone truly and genuinely believes that what I do puts my soul in jeopardy,
yeah,
and they're trying to help me,
yeah,
that's kind of sweet. I mean, they barely know me and they're that concerned about my spiritual well-being that they want to talk to me about it.
Mm-hmm.
I can deal with that. Mm-hmm. Now, if I tell them to stop and they keep doing it, then they're being jerks and, you know, I may have to get rude with them. But, you know, most people I've encountered haven't. Mm-hmm. A lot of it is more of a dismissive attitude.
Mm-hmm.
I actually helped with a political campaign once for a candidate in a Republican primary.
Mm-hmm.
And I actually mentioned to her that I was pagan, and she just made the comment, well, we just won't mention that. And it's like, why not? Don't you want to know that your policies are so awesome that you have pagans supporting you? I mean, wouldn't that be a bonus? But, mm-hmm. you know, it was very dismissive. And I can kind of see that could be turned to a negative for a political campaign. But, you know, those kinds of things. I haven't worried about it in situations of, like, child custody or anything like that.
Oh,
Mostly because my ex-wife was pretty okay with it. Mm-hmm. She did refer to it as that weird stuff I'm into. But, you know, and she's never been aggressive about anything like that. So, yeah.
Is your son involved in any of this kind of stuff or not really?
No.
No.
I would say that's probably the biggest concern that I've had is that my ex-wife is... nominally Christian.
Mm-hmm.
And we basically made an agreement when we had a divorce that my son would not be involved in that weird stuff that I'm involved in.
I see.
At least until he became an adult and was able to make his own decisions into it. So he was raised vaguely Christian, as mm-hmm. I call it. I guess you'd call it non-denominational something or other. But he's vaguely Christian, and he's been allowed to go with me to psychic fairs and stuff like that, where I've done tarot readings mm-hmm. or even helped out. And that seems to be okay.
Yeah.
But he's not pagan in any sense. He isn't involved in any of that stuff. And I honestly don't know what he would think about it, because mm-hmm. we haven't had those discussions.
Well, that's interesting.
He is getting old. He is getting near that age where I'm going to start talking to my ex-wife about...
Yeah.
Would it be okay if I talked to him about it? I don't know if he'd be interested or not.
He
could kind of make his own choice on that.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Okay, and then I have sort of a question that you can take any way you want, which is that, is there anything special about being a pagan in Kansas? Is there anything special about the experience of it, do you think?
Well, I don't know, because I haven't been a pagan anywhere else.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm not sure. The pagan community in Kansas City is very vibrant. We have a very, I mean, there's always infighting, mm-hmm. especially in paganism. It's going to happen in any community where you have a bunch of small groups with strong leaders that have strong personalities.
Can attest to that. Yeah.
But the pagan community in this area is pretty good.
Mm-hmm.
And they're pretty supportive. As long as you don't bruise certain egos.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's actually a resource, and I think it's valuable, and I don't know, I know that there are a lot of other places where that's not the case. Wichita is supposed to have a very, very tight-lipped and prone to infighting pagan community. I've talked to people that have come from out there, and they've come to Kansas City, and they just talk about how relaxed it is out here and how everyone's friendly and engaging, and out there everyone's very secretive, and this group will talk smack on that group and they're fighting them and everything else, and
mm-hmm.
there's a lot of that seems to be going along.
Yeah.
In Manhattan you have a lot of Norse paganism,
mm-hmm.
In part because there's a strong military community there, and that tends to draw the heathen crowd.
Mm-hmm.
But again, I mean, Kansas is an unusual place on its own, because it's a conservative place that has historically had progressive ideas. Mm-hmm. And so you've got this kind of interesting mix there where the general population leans conservative on some issues you wouldn't expect them to, and leans liberal on some issues you might not expect them to, for being a, quote, red state. And so, and some aspects of that pagan religiosity fit in very well to Kansas, and some of them don't. It really depends on how you present it, I suppose.
Yeah, I mean, I guess I'm kind of wondering, too, about, you know, so I've talked to you, and I've talked to Jeremy so far, and Jeremy is obviously, you know, very liberal Democrat, whatever, and you, on the other hand, were, like, working for a Republican campaign. Do you find that the community tends one way or the other, or pagans tend one way or the other in Kansas, or are they pretty split?
If you're dealing with heathens, they're most likely to be politically conservative. Most of the pagans that I've dealt with, personally, I'm much more of a libertarian. I deal with the Republican Party because that way I can influence the primaries. But they, in general, the pagan community in Kansas doesn't tend to get much farther right than libertarian-esque, and they tend to be very liberal. And in fact, I have been more accepted as an open pagan in Republican circles than I have as a Republican in some pagan circles.
I can see that.
In fact, I had one lady, at, one girl at Camp Gaia yelling at me for about 5 minutes because I mentioned I was Republican, and she was screaming at me about how Republicans steal money, food, and birth control from poor people. And I mean, I just, I had no idea what she was going on about. I was like, I've never broken into anybody's house and stolen condoms. You know, I if you want to have a discussion about some issues, we can do that, but you're being kind of mean. So, and still in both of those circles, they're a little skeptical of, you know, why are you here? I've been accused because I'm a capitalist. I've been accused of being a Christian plant in some pagan groups.
Interesting. COINTELBRO's coming back or whatever.
You know, it's whatever. Some people, and I think a lot of that is because you have people, especially in a more conservative place. Paganism in general tends to be very open and accepting, and it's an outsider religion. So if you don't fit in for whatever reason, they'll take you in. And so there's a lot of rejection of mainstream cultural values or anything seen as conservative. And, it, you know, it's it's a fair critique. I mean, I've supported gay marriage for quite some time. And the Republican Party still seems to not be catching up with that. And I've been vocal of the Republican Party for it, and that's kind of aggravated some of my Republican friends. But, you know, the, a lot of those issues go back and forth, but the community itself tends to be much more politically liberal than anything else.
Interesting. Okay. Well, then, I guess, finally, I would just say, is there anything else you want to say? No. Anything you think we haven't covered or that you think is important?
Not really. I didn't know if you'd wanted to talk about the WPA or anything like that.
The WPA?
The Wiccan Pagan Alliance.
I don't know anything about that, actually. Oh. I was asking Jeremy a little bit about the when it was the Cauldron, but yeah, tell me about that.
Well, it's a funny story because when I was originally commuting to Lawrence, to KU from Overland Park, and I was just looking for a group to join in. And it's funny because I was hoping to meet women.
Well,
it's a common theme, I know.
Yeah.
The irony is that I ended up meeting a woman that I dated for 6.5 years in that group. She wasn't even pagan. No, it was a student group, and it offered a lot of support for, it wasn't just the students, because about half the members weren't students. They were just locals from Lawrence.
Okay.
And that helped me, I met a lot of friends through that, and that helped me integrate into the community in general in Lawrence. But it was basically, we had discussions once a week.
Yeah.
And that was pretty much it, and we had a couple of ritual activities and everything, but it helped me develop more of a leadership role as I was president for a couple years.
Oh, okay.
But it was just another networking group.
Mm-hmm.
We tried to be as active as possible and advertise for the student community and cater to them, but eventually the influence from the people that weren't students was... And we talked about actually splitting the group up and having a group that was just for the locals and a group that was just for the students, and that never worked. And then there was the name change to Caden Cauldron, and then the name changed back eventually. And but it was a group. It was a group that stood out a little bit. We tried to make it shine a little bit for the campus community, and we did attract a lot of people there and had some pretty active discussions going on there for a little while. And it's in its more active years, and I think that did help people who were not sure about where to go, or that weren't sure how to approach an interest in paganism. We had a lot of people that would come for a couple sessions, ask a lot of questions, and then kind of go off on their own. And I've even encountered some of them later on, and you know, that group wasn't for them, but we pointed them in the right direction. And when you're dealing with college age people that are just leaving home and trying to figure out who they are and trying to access resources that are different, you know, outside of what they can normally get, that's very important. And so I think that group was a good thing. I kind of hope that they get enough people to start it up again sometime.
I was surprised to discover that it was sort of defunct.
The membership dwindled down to about 3 people, and they didn't have enough people to actually have the necessary officers. So it kind of went down.
Gotcha. Okay.
But that's the general gist of it.
Anything else?
Not that I can think of. Is there anything else you'd like to ask about?
I don't think so. I think I've pretty much covered. So thank you so much. This was really great.
Thank you.